It is our expression that sometimes the icicles themselves have fallen, as if by concussion, or as if something had swept against the underside of an aerial ice floe, detaching its papillations. Monthly Weather Review, June, 1889. That, at Oswego, N.Y., June 11, 1889, according to the Turin, N.Y. Leader, there fell, in a thunderstorm, pieces of ice that resembled the fragments of icicles. Monthly Weather Review, 29-506. That on Florence Island, St. Lawrence River, August 8, 1901, with ordinary hail, fell pieces of ice formed like icicles, the size and shape of lead pencils that had been cut into sections about 3/8 of an inch in length. So our data of the Super Sargasso Sea, and its Arctic region, and, for weeks at a time, an ice field may hang motionless over a part of this Earth's surface. The sun has some effect upon it, but not much until late in the afternoon, I should say part of it has sagged, but is held up by cohesion with the main mass, whereupon we have such an occurrence as would have been a little uncanny to us once upon a time, or fall of water from a cloudless sky, day after day, in one small part of this Earth's surface, late in the afternoon, when the sun's rays had had time for their effects. Monthly Weather Review, October, 1886. That, according to the Charlotte Chronicle, October 21, 1886, for 3 weeks there had been a fall of water from the sky, in Charlotte, N.C., localized in one particular spot, every afternoon, about 3 o'clock, that, whether the sky was cloudy or cloudless, the water or rain fell upon a small patch of land between two trees and nowhere else. This is the newspaper account, and, as such, it seems in the depths of the unchosen, either by me or any other expression of the Salvation Army. The account by the Signal Service Observer, at Charlotte, published in the Review, follows. An unusual phenomenon was witnessed on the 21st, having been informed that, for some weeks prior to date, rain had been falling daily, after 3 p.m., on a particular spot, near two trees, corner of 9th and D Streets. I visited the place, and saw precipitation in the form of raindrops at 4:47 and 4:55 p.m., while the sun was shining brightly. On the 22nd, I again visited the place, and from 4:05 to 4:25 p.m., a light shower of rain fell from a cloudless sky. Sometimes the precipitation falls over an area of half an acre, but always appears to center at these two trees, and when lightest occurs there only. 14. We see conventionally. It is not only that we think and act and speak and dress alike, because of our surrender to social attempt at entity, in which we are only supercellular. We see what it is proper that we should see. It is orthodox enough to say that a horse is not a horse, to an infant any more than is an orange to the unsophisticated. It's interesting to walk along a street sometimes and look at things and wonder what they'd look like, if we hadn't been taught to see horses and trees and houses as horses and trees and houses. I think that to supersight they are local stresses merging indistinguishably into one another, in an all-inclusive nexus. I think that it would be credible enough to say that many times have Monstrator and Elvira and Azuria crossed telescopic fields of vision, and were not even seen because it wouldn't be proper to see them, it wouldn't be respectable, and it wouldn't be respectful. It would be insulting to old bones to see them, it would bring on evil influences from the relics of St. Isaac to see them. But our data of vast worlds that are orbitless, or that are navigable, or that are adrift in interplanetary tides and currents, the data that we shall have of their approach, in modern times, within 5 or 6 miles of this Earth. But then their visits, or approaches, to other planets, or to other of the few regularized bodies that have surrendered to the attempted entity of this solar system as a whole. The question that we can't very well evade. Have these other worlds, or superconstructions, ever been seen by astronomers? I think there would not be much approximation to realness in taking refuge in the notion of astronomers who stare and squint and see only that which it is respectable and respectful to see. It is all very well to say that astronomers are hypnotics, and that an astronomer looking at the moon is hypnotized by the moon, but our acceptance is that the bodies of this present expression often visit the moon, or cross it, or are held in temporary suspension near it, then some of them must often have been within the diameter of an astronomer's hypnosis. Our general expression that, upon the oceans of this earth, there are regularized vessels, but also that there are tramp vessels. That, upon the superocean, there are regularized planets, but also that there are tramp worlds. That astronomers are like mercantile purists who would deny commercial vagabondage. Our acceptance is that vast celestial vagabonds have been excluded by astronomers, primarily because their irresponsibilities are an affront to the pure and the precise, or to attempted positivism, and secondarily because they have not been seen so very often. The planets steadily reflect the light of the sun. Upon this uniformity a system that we call primary astronomy has been built up, but now the subject matter of advanced astronomy is data of celestial phenomena that are sometimes light and sometimes dark, varying like some of the satellites of Jupiter, but with a wider range. However, light or dark, they have been seen and reported so often that the only important reason for their exclusion is that they don't fit in with dark bodies that are probably external to our own solar system. I have, in the provincialism that no one can escape, not much concern. Dark bodies afloat in outer space would have been damned a few years ago, but now they're sanctioned by Professor Barnard and, if he says they're all right, you may think of them without the fear of doing something wrong or ridiculous. The close kinship we note so often between the evil and the absurd, I suppose by the ridiculous I mean the froth of evil. The dark companion of Algol, for instance. Though that's a clear case of celestial miscegenation, the purists, or positivists, admit that's so. In the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, 1915-394, Professor Barnard writes of an object, he calls it an object in Cephas. His idea is that there are dark, opaque bodies outside this solar system. But in the Astrophysical Journal, 1916-1, he modifies into regarding them as dark nebulae. That's not so interesting. We accept that Venus, for instance, has often been visited by other worlds, or by superconstructions, from which come ciders and coke and coal, that sometimes these things have reflected light and have been seen from this earth by professional astronomers. It will be noted that throughout this chapter our data are accursed Brahmins as, by hypnosis and inertia, we keep on and keep on saying, just as a good many of the scientists of the 19th century kept on and kept on admitting the power of the system that preceded them or continuity would be smashed. There's a big chance here for us to be instantaneously translated to the positive absolute. Oh, well. What I emphasize here is that our damned data are observations by astronomers of the highest standing, excommunicated by astronomers of similar standing but backed up by the dominant spirit of their era to which all minds had to equilibrate or be negligible, unheard, submerged. It would seem sometimes, in this book, as if our revolts were against the dogmatisms and pontifications of single scientists of eminence. This is only a convenience, because it seems necessary to personify. If we look over philosophical transactions, or the publications of the Royal Astronomical Society, for instance, we see that Herschel, for instance, was as powerless as any boy stargazer, to enforce acceptance of any observation of his that did not harmonize with the system that was growing up as independently of him and all other astronomers, as a phase in the development of an embryo compels all cells to take on appearances concordantly with the design and the predetermined progress and schedule of the whole. Visitors to Venus. Evans, Ways of the Planets, p. 140. That, in 1645, a body large enough to look like a satellite was seen near Venus. Four times in the first half of the 18th century, a similar observation was reported. The last report occurred in 1767. A large body has been seen seven times, according to Science Gossip, 1886-178 near Venus. At least one astronomer, Houzeau, accepted these observations and named the world, planet, superconstruction Neith. His views are mentioned in passing, but without endorsement, in the Transaction NY Academic, 5-249. Howzo or someone writing for the magazine section of a Sunday newspaper, outer darkness for both alike. A new satellite in this solar system might be a little disturbing, though the formulas of Laplace, which were considered final in his day, have survived the admittance of 500 or 600 bodies not included in those formulas. A satellite to Venus might be a little disturbing, but would be explained. But a large body approaching a planet, staying a while, going away, coming back some other time, anchoring, as it were. Azuria is pretty bad, but Azuria is no worse than Neith. Astrophysical Journal, 1-127. A light reflecting body, or a bright spot near Mars, seen November 25, 1894, by Professor Pickering and others, at the Lowell Observatory, above an unilluminated part of Mars self-luminous, it would seem thought to have been a cloud but estimated to have been about 20 miles away from the planet. Luminous spot seen moving across the disk of Mercury, in 1799, by Harding and Schroeder. Monthly Notices of the RAS, 38-338.